On this episode of Still Loading, we awaken from a 100-year slumber. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. My name is Josh Koval. I am your host of this podcast. And today I am very excited because I have a guest on the show to talk about a game that is near and dear, especially to him, but to many of us. Today on the podcast, we are talking Breath of the Wild. And with me, he is a lieutenant in the Sploosh Troop, which I have no idea what that is. I saw it was an esports thing. But he's a lieutenant in the Sploosh Troop, a full-time streamer on Twitch, and a gamer to his very core. Xwater is with me today. Xwater, how are you doing today, sir?
Oh man, I'm doing solid, letting the voice recover a little bit on the days off. A huge sacrifice to be on a podcast while on my recovery days, so you know, you're welcome on that one.
I feel privileged. I feel blessed to have you on here.
Yeah, no, I'm just playing around. No, I'm having a great day, man. I did some shopping, set up some Christmas decorations in the house. Probably gonna do some gaming later, as I do. And That's the day, man. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining me. I'm doing pretty well. Just tired. I'm always tired because of work, but you know what? That's to be expected.
That's adulthood. That's the subtitle to adulthood. Always tired.
I feel like my go-to response whenever someone's like, how are you doing? My go-to response is, I'm tired. I might not even be tired. It's just ingrained that is my go-to response that I just have to tell them, like, oh, I'm just exhausted.
Just fly on tired.
Constant.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you though, do you play as a full-time streamer? Are there games that you specifically choose to not play on stream as like, this is my me time game, which sounds gross, but this is my me time game?
I play a lot of Tetris 99 off stream. I like that. The things I'll play mostly off stream are not necessarily because I don't want to share them, but it's like, I, as a full-time streamer, my stuff that I stream is like things that I know my audience wants to see, but there are games I want to play that I know my audience doesn't want to see. So oftentimes I'll save that for my me time, or like when I'm gaming with friends. And when I'm gaming with friends, like, I don't want to force them to be a part of my production. So I'm like, I will like spend my off stream time gaming with you so we can like have personal conversations and joke about stuff. When there's 200 people watching you versus you're with your three closest friends, you definitely have to like tone it back a little bit. Like, you can't, you have to especially be watching like everything that happens on your stream, and you have to also be like keeping those 200 or 100, however many people are watching, engaged. And that's not something I want to do when I'm just trying to spend quality time with like homies. So I'll use
sense.
Yeah, I've been playing a lot of Ghost of Tsushima multiplayer with my friends lately.
I still need to get that. I asked my wife for it for Christmas, so hopefully
nice,
I'll pick that up.
Yeah,
We've been having to save money, otherwise I would have, because we have our first kid on the way. So,
oh, congratulations. That's incredible.
Thank you. I find a way to sneak that in every episode just about, just so I can hear a congratulations. No.
Has anyone given you the oh no? Whenever someone says they're having a kid, it's like you either get the congratulations or the oh no.
Trying to think. I don't think anyone has.
I feel like oh no is less common the older you get. Like if you're 21, you're going, I'm having a kid. The oh no is a lot more likely.
No, 100%. It's the, yeah, no, I don't, I'm 31. So most of the people my age are like, oh yay, congratulations.
Yeah.
Though I went on a like this missions trip thing a year ago or so, and everyone didn't think I was in my 30s. They thought I was still like 21 or 22. I'm like, I'll take that. Damn. Like, seriously.
Gladly, for real.
No, I was just asking because, like, when I stream to my 5 viewers, not your 200 or so, whatever, I always feel like I have to, like you said, you kind of have to be on a little bit. So
yeah, you do. Absolutely.
Even to my small viewership, whatever, there are certain games that I feel like I can be entertaining on and others that I can't. Like, anything that is heavy in story, I can't do it because
same.
I'm so focused.
Yeah,
I'm
like I want to know what's happening. I can't play The Witcher on stream, man. Like, I wanted to, and then I want to chat with my chat, but then like they start going into 30 minutes of dialogue and I'm like, well, I can't talk to you guys right now. I gotta watch this.
I did. There's a streamer I became friends with named, oh my gosh, I feel so bad. It's Blue something. I've referenced him before. I was going to say Author Blues, but that's not him. I don't know Author Blues. Gathering Blues, that's his name. And he does a lot of like really heavy JRPG stuff. Like he did Fire Emblem. He did Xenoblade 1 and 2. He's done some of those. And so what he does is that he will just mute his audio and has a little disclaimer like, during cutscenes, I'm not talking. It's not that I'm ignoring you. I'm just focusing on the cutscenes.
Yeah.
And so that's how he kind of does it. But he also has a much smaller audience than you do of, you know, a couple hundred people watch you versus his is like in between like the 30s and 50s type of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and however you build your brand is however like that works. So if he builds up to the levels you, like playing those games and using those strategies, then something where he switches over to the kind of content I do might rub his community the wrong way and like drop his viewership. Not in like the sense where they feel like slighted, but you know, people who like watching Fire Emblem probably don't like watching Mario as much, and vice versa. So I learned at some point in the full-time streaming career that like you kind of gotta like, you can't just play whatever you want to play. You gotta strategically choose what to play. And considering I built my like, I got partnered playing Mario Maker, that's like the realm I kind of locked myself in. I was able to get out of Mario Maker, but now I'm like in this extended Nintendo universe. And that's the content that I kind of really wanted to get into with streaming. So like, I feel like I finally landed where I want to be, but I'm very aware that despite how much I love JRPGs, people probably don't want to watch me play them.
That makes sense. Especially, I mean, with all your Animal Crossing content now too, I love your game shows, by the way, your Dell or No Dell.
Thank you.
And, I forget what all the other ones, the Spider Casino that you made, Tarantula Casino.
Yeah. That's what it was.
I actually showed, so my wife is not into gaming pretty much at all, but I showed her the video that you did with Dragon Feeny and all the Survivor Island on Animal Crossing.
Yeah.
And your explosion, your rant in the first episode is some of my favorite moments, just period.
Oh, like, I'm glad, because when I went so in there, I was so pissed. Like nervous about it, because I wanted it to feel like reality TV, you know, like when they go into those moments in reality TV on the actual show, like they don't hold back. They're not being like, yo, the opponents played a real good game. I wanted to go in like a salty bitch. So I was like, motherfucker, I can't believe this shit went down like that.
It was so funny. Oh my god, I showed it to her and my sister-in-law and both they were dying. It was so funny. But okay, so we are here to talk about Breath of the Wild.
Yes. Amazing game.
It really is. And the reason I wanted to have you on is actually twofold. And before I reached out to you, I didn't know this at the time, so this kind of works out, but two reasons. One, you did that full 900 plus core. Is there 900 or over 900 core?
There are 900 seeds on the dial.
All right.
Yeah.
And you know that because you got every single one of them.
I absolutely did. Yep. Without a guide. That's the most important part. I did it without using a guide.
Mm-hmm. I do remember some douchebag did steal it from you, the last one. He spoiled the very last one for you.
Yeah, my community had been following it. I have in my Discord a channel that I'm not allowed to look in. It's for them to, like, you know, shit talk me, talk spoilers, whatever they want to do in there. I don't look. So when I was doing Zelda, they actually scoured my VODs for hours to find which seed I missed, and they found out that it was that particular seed, and it was, like, right outside of the plateau. Like, it wasn't even far from the starting area.
Yeah.
But some kid went into that channel and then used bits in my chat to do text-to-speech. And so, like, I couldn't, like, my mods couldn't even time it out in time. Like, it just happened in my ears and spoiled the location. So it is what it is. But, you know, it was definitely, I felt very robbed at the end there. But I would have had that one within the next, like, 20 hours, I feel like. So
Oh, only 20 hours.
Yeah.
I will say, though, despite it being stolen from you. That is an impressive level of community coordination to go back through all of your previous VODs to determine the 899 other right. locations that you already got. That's insane.
It's
that
crazy.
Is a huge. So as much as that sucks, the fact of the matter is, even though that kid probably, I don't know, maybe they participated in it, maybe they didn't. But the fact that kid, even if they didn't participate in it, that was only occurred because your community had your back so much that they found, they searched through the 899 other locations to make sure which ones you had. That's
and we got
crazy.
So far. We were like 15 hours into that final seed before it happened. Like, it was the restraint shown by people at that time was crazy, because that was like the peak of my Twitch career thus far. Like, my viewership was on average like 400, 500, 600, which is like numbers that I dream about, and getting like, one day I'm gonna be back up there, but I haven't seen that in a little bit. So it's,
you gotta find that next thing to do.
Yeah, well, Super Mario Sunshine has brought me back into like the 250s ish area, which is really cool to see. I'm on a nice little uptrend with. Right now I'm working on the perfect run, which is, I have the 3D All Stars collection, and the goal is to beat Mario 64, Sunshine, and Galaxy back to back to back. No point, no damage among all three.
Oof.
In a row.
Ooh.
And so I finally successfully completed just Sunshine alone, and now I'm working on Galaxy, and then I'm going to do 64, and then I just got to slap those three together and start doing full attempts of all three of them in a row.
Do you think that'll be a new speedrunning category at some point?
Absolutely not. I don't think anyone's crazy enough to do it.
That would be a long, you would have to have like those scheduled breaks like they do in like the full run of Breath of the Wild and stuff like that. Or what's, there is some game
in
where
Breath
they have
of the
like
Wild,
scheduled
they do
breaks.
Have that, yeah, for 100%.
That's what it is.
Mm-hmm. You can have, like, there's like rules about how often you can take breaks and how long until you get the break, but it is in place.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
But no, I had you on for the first reason, the 900 Korok seeds. The second one, I believe your company, Warp World, just added crowd control support for Breath of the Wild, didn't it?
We did, yeah. And oh my God, it's fun, dude. Oh, it's so crazy to just be playing Breath of the Wild, and then to have people being able to just smite you with lightning or make your weapons comically big, or even force you to like stop being able to move. Like, all these separate effects are just so wild for the experience. It was an outrageous good time.
Now, for those who don't know what crowd control is, Xwater, could you explain to them what crowd control is? It's specific to Twitch. It's not something you're really going to see outside of that in any possible way. So what is crowd control?
Absolutely, man. Yeah, crowd control is essentially right now a Twitch extension. It is software that hooks into various games, be it like NES games, SNES games, Game Boy games, Sega games, PS1 games, cover a lot of different platforms. But how it essentially works is the Twitch streamer will hook this software into their game. And let's just use the example of Mario 64. So if I'm playing Mario 64 and I'm streaming it, people in my chat can now use this extension to, you'll have to get coins first, and you can have free coins by default. You can also get a bit of free coins if you're subscribed, and then if you're subscribed to like Warp World Elite. But anyway, you get these coins and you can spend these coins on effects. Now, it operates in a way where like you can exchange your bits on Twitch for coins. So essentially you're buying coins, right? And it's like, you can do things like, if you spend $3, you can kill Mario instantly. If you spend $10, you can remove every star that was collected in Thwomp's Fortress, so the player has to recollect them. If you spend like $2, you can make Mario super fast or super slow or just all these weird things. And each streamer can set their own prices, so it can be as fair or unfair as they desire it to be. And it's this really amazing experience. Makes for some of the funnest event streams that like you can run into on Twitch.
They did one on GDQ this past year with a with Link to the Past randomizer with Andy, and that was one of the most fun runs I've seen. Just the fact you could, they would switch up his controller inputs randomly, so
yeah,
have
that's
to
a rough
adjust
one
to
deal
that
with
on the fly.
Yeah,
the cuckoo attacks and everything. Like, there's so many great ideas. So yeah, that's why I wanted to have you on, because I knew, one, you had an intimate knowledge of the game because you 900 Korok seeds, but two, also it was completely coincidental. It worked out that right when I asked you is when Warp World announced that there is Breath of the Wild support, which is really fucking cool.
Yeah.
So to dive into it, One of the first things I want to talk about is what Breath of the Wild... Let's go through the story first, just so people have the context of what the game is and what the whole narrative of the story is. Because then I want to go into how Breath of the Wild breaks Zelda's conventions. I'm assuming you're a pretty big Zelda fan then,
huge,
correct?
Huge, yeah.
So with Breath of the Wild, the story, it gets criticized a decent amount. What is your take on it?
I think it's actually a really well done... really well done story given the format of the game. Like, people will say that it lacks story, and while I kind of see where they're coming from, the way I think about it more is that because of the format of Breath of the Wild being like you can approach Ganon directly, like right away, you like can do two beasts and fight him, you can like miss out on so much of the world, they had to kind of build it so it works in that sense. So it's not so much that you're playing through a story, but you get to discover the lore, and the story is within the lore of that world. So you go around and each, you know, like each region has kind of a story going on. Like you go to the Gerudo village, and you know, you got to go get the helm back from the Yiga clan, and bam, you got some story in there, but it's all optional. It's not that important. What's important is the stuff that happened in the past that you experience while you're there. You see the cutscenes of like Vonnebouris being like used for the first time, and how Zelda and Urbosa were hanging out on it, and how they had this like mentor relationship between each other. Mm-hmm. Almost like Urbosa played like a motherly role to Zelda. And you're finding out all this by like flashbacks. And so the whole story is done in that way, which maybe it doesn't lead to like the craving people have from a Zelda game for the story, but for what they did with the gameplay, I think it nailed it. I loved it. I thought it was like pretty good.
I agree with you on that. I feel like the way they designed the game, that's the only way you could tell that story, because since the gameplay, since the majority of the content in the game is so optional, it is so reliant on the player's skill to determine how. That's what's kind of an interesting, but to not to break too much into the mechanics are a part of it. But what's interesting about the game is that the player's skill determines the linearity of the game.
Absolutely.
Where if the higher skilled you are, the more linear the game becomes, because you can just go straight to Ganon and you can fight him at his full health the whole way through.
Even if the higher skill you are, it can even become less linear, because the desert's a hard region to go to, and if you're not good at the game, going to the desert first, you're gonna get your ass smacked. Like, those lightning lizards are not easy to deal with. So most players I found ended up starting with either the bird or the elephant, either the Rito village or the Zora village. But if you like, if you're really good at the game, you know your stuff, you can do the Goron village first or the Gerudo village first. Or apart from that, like, you can go all the way up to like Hebra Mountain and do the snowboarding side quests first. So you have a point where when you are really skilled, you can just jump and beat the game immediately, but you also can do anything because you're just good at it.
It makes sense. I was just thinking more of like in terms of the straight story aspect of that, you can, once you get good enough, you can ignore all the divine beasts and just go straight to Ganon. But with that said, since we are talking about the story, when you were talking about how a lot of the story is told through flashbacks, so the actual story of what you play through is relatively simple, but all the interesting stuff occurs prior to Link Awakening. So Link, the hero of all the Zelda series, for those who don't know, if you're listening to this and you don't know that, I'm surprised, but always just in case. So Kevin Smith talks about the Stanley method of comic book writing is that always treat every comic book like it's someone's first comic book. So I always try to do that with podcasts. It should be obvious, but because if you're into games and you should know this, but sometimes people just don't know about stuff, even game series as popular as Zelda. I don't know why I put such a long fucking disclaimer on that. Most people I don't think really care, but in any case, with Breath of the Wild, the main story of the game, you play as Link and you are an amnesiac who wakes up 100. You don't know at the time, but you wake up 100 years later from when you went to sleep, and you awaken to this world of Hyrule that you see. The first thing you see is the castle with Calamity. Like, the first thing once you get out of your tomb, for lack of a better term, your sleeping chamber, is the castle with Calamity Ganon swirling around it. And that sets up immediately what your objective is. You see that evil thing off in the distance, you got to go find a way to defeat it. And the game then basically tells Link, you know, as you play through the game world, you learn about how Link got there, how he came under this spell, how he went into this coma for 100 years. But for all intents and purposes, Link has to go and defeat Calamity Ganon. And that's the story. The extra stuff that you shouldn't skip unless you're really fucking good at the game is going to each of the races. Zora, what's the birds? The Ritos, right?
The Rito, yeah.
Rito?
Yeah.
The Gerudos in the desert, and what's the fourth one that I'm missing? The Gorons.
The Goron.
And each race has this thing called a Divine Beast, which is this giant machine that was meant to fight Calamity Ganon. They were taken over by Ganon, which you learned later on. And so if you rescue each one of those four, they will then help you defeat Calamity Ganon at the end of the game. That's the simple version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The actual more complex is through all the lore. And one of the things that you said that reminded me of this is that the way they tell the story of the background story, it kind of reminds me of BioShock, just without the major plot twist at the end of the game. Have you played BioShock?
Yeah, love BioShock.
So you know how you go and you listen to all the journals of people who live in Rapture and you kind of hear their backstory as you go through? Mm-hmm. They kind of do that with this. There's not as many journals, which I'm actually very thankful for, because there's a lot in BioShock. And you kind of collect the memories that you get, what was it, in Kakariko Village.
Yeah, you know, yeah, you pick up. Yeah, you go, Impa will give you like 12 locations and each one gives you essentially one of these past cutscenes.
Exactly. And I thought that was a cool way to do it, where there's so much lore in the background of the story that is told through these flashbacks, and also told, even if you don't get the memories from Impa, and or she, even if you don't learn of the memory, even if you don't learn of the memories from Impa, you will still get flashbacks as you go to fight the four divine beasts.
Yeah, you're still going to get like your champion flashbacks, like from the descendants of the champions, or the people who are like the modern day versions of them in each village. Like there's each village kind of has their current day. I wouldn't call them a champion because they're not, but like leader of the village in some way, or warrior of the village. Like you have the prince in the Zora village, Sidon, mm-hmm. who's like, he helps you get onto the elephant. You've got, can't remember the name of the bird guy, but the bird guy who helps you get onto the bird.
Let me see if I can look it up real quick. That's one of the things I always have open is just a synopsis page, because no matter how often you play a game, you're always going to forget some surprisingly important, not, I shouldn't say important, but surprisingly like big details of the story, no matter how often you play it, unless you're like intimately familiar with it. I'm trying to see if I can look it up now, but that's going to...
Yeah.
Revali is the... Yeah, sorry, yeah, go on.
So not Revali, but the person in the future that you fight alongside to get to the Divine Beast. But anyway, there's one of these in each of the villages that you kind of work with to get to the beast. And they're kind of like they kind of are your lens into the champion. And that's like really, really cool that even if you don't do the memories, you still get to experience so much lore behind the champions.
Just trying to look that up. I'm just on Google, and I got an ad from Walmart for a Link Breath of the Wild costume from Walmart. And it's this awkward looking little kid just staring right into your soul. It's really weird. Anyway, no, and I also like that those characters in each of the different races, whether it's with Gorons, the Zora, or the Gerudos. One of the things I like is that they kind of offer you a lens into that race's culture and into that race's world just a little bit. So you get a little bit more depth out of it. I'm trying to see it now. Of course it's all alphabetical, so that doesn't help me. I was hoping it would list it by the individual races or something like that, but that's not helping me. Yeah, no. All right.
Yeah, it's
Let's
fine.
Not worry about
it's not that important.
But yeah, so you learn through all these different flashbacks, and what you learn is that what is it, 10,000 years ago? So 100 years ago is when Link goes to sleep, but 10,000 years prior is when Calamity Ganon first appears on the scene, if I remember correctly.
I don't know if I remember that. I know like the Sheikah technology is like tens of thousands years old, is like kind of the big plot point around that, where like all of the divine beasts and the guardians and all of this, and the Sheikah slates, like all of this stuff is like basically ancient super tech at this point that exists, but nobody knows how it works. So you can't make more of it, and you can't really like do, like there are researchers who are trying to manipulate it, and that's where you get like your Pura and your Robbie and the other too. Characters. And Princess Zelda herself, yeah, she's trying to learn how to manipulate the Sheikah technology as well, because if they can command the Guardians, then that's power against Calamity Ganon.
So reading a synopsis, it says, you know, 10,000 years prior to the events of the beginning of the game, Hyrule is an advanced civilization. I'm reading this off of Wikipedia just so people don't think that I'm that smart that I can surmise it. Hyrule is an advanced civilization protected by four enormous animalistic machines called the Divine Beasts. Like we mentioned before, the beasts that you have to go fight in order to help you beat Ganon. And an army of autonomous weapons called the Guardians, which we saw.
Yeah.
Fun fact, actually, I did a little bit of research. The Guardians were designed... Eiji Aonuma, when he came up with... He helped come up with the ideas for the Guardians, and it was because when he looked at the Octoroks from the original Legend of Zelda... He thought they were much, like, in his imagination as a kid, they were so much larger than what they ended up being in the 3D Zelda games.
Wow, so, that's really cool. I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm. So that's why they kind of, and if you look at, like, an Octorok from a top thing, how it's a circular shape, it's kind of like a similar thing where they, it's kind of like an octopus type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But they decided to not make it look like an animal because that would be too gross and slimy. So they turned it into... the Sheikah technology that you see in the game, so that way it looks more tech-based versus just gross.
Yeah, it's a lot less disgusting to chop off the arm of a gigantic robot because it's just, like, gears sticking out and not, like, oozing weird goopy blood.
Exactly, exactly. And so when the evil Calamity Ganon appears and threatens Hyrule, the four great warriors that were given the title of champion pilot one of the divine beasts to weaken Ganon, while the princess with the blood of the goddess and her appointed knight fought and defeated him by sealing him away. 9,900 years later is where you see a lot of the flashbacks then. That's where you see they kind of get the idea that they kind of see that Calamity Ganon is going to come back, but Hyrule has devolved into a more medieval state, hence what you were saying,
yeah,
where there's all this Sheikah technology, but no one knows how to use it. And
exactly.
And I love the fact that Zelda is not just like what she is in other games, where she's literally just the damsel in distress. Like, she's taking such an active part in trying to defeat...
I think they've done a good job in a lot of games not giving her that role, though. Like, if you think of Zelda in... Skyward Sword, even she does get captured, but she does a lot behind the scenes in that game, and in Twilight Princess especially, she's badass.
See, I haven't played Skyward Sword yet. I'm behind on that. Ooh. I couldn't get into Twilight Princess. I don't know what it is about that game.
It's got like a 2.5 hour like almost like tutorial. Like the start of that game is pretty slow.
For me, it was just the Zelda formula done to not the best way. Like, you know, the classic Zelda formula, and we'll get into it once we talk about the gameplay in more in depth, but how, like, you get an item in the dungeon and then you use it to defeat the boss. That spinny top, you don't use that anywhere else with the exception of the boss and maybe a couple walls.
Yeah, you get a heart piece or two out of it.
And that's about it. There's no other reason for that item to exist. It's a cool boss fight. It's one of the coolest boss fights you'll play.
It's badass. Yeah, it's awesome.
Great boss fight. But I just couldn't get into it. But you, I guess you are right, though, because even without those two examples you mentioned, look at Wind Waker. Tetra is a pirate who literally does, like, she fucks off for half the game and Link doesn't even see her. Like, she doesn't get captured till the end once Ganon finds out she is a descendant of Princess Zelda, or the reincarnation of Princess Zelda.
Yeah, but, like, you're totally right. In Breath of the Wild, they give Zelda such a, like, almost the, and this is something that we covered in Warp World Historians, we did an episode about this game, and, like, because of how the game is presented, like Link's never been the character that you're supposed to like resonate with as much. Link's the character that's supposed to be your like your connection into the world, which is why from the beginning they even called him Link. Like he's the link between you and the game. And that's like the whole meaning behind them naming him that. But in Breath of the Wild, Zelda is quite like literally the main character in my head, like in terms of the story. Like Link is just this buff dude who comes and like watches it and is the bodyguard. But like every story piece in this game is about Zelda and her quest to essentially stop the world from getting fucked up.
I also like that when she first meets Link, because essentially, you know, 9,900 years later, when Zelda is getting the idea that Calamity Ganon is coming back, so she's trying to mobilize, she's trying to find, they dig up the Divine Beast and they try to find new champions for the Divine Beast, which are the characters that you meet as ghosts in the future, in the current gameplay, where Daruk, who's the warrior for the Goron, Mipha is the princess for the Zora, which I kind of liked that they still kept that hint of the Zora princess having a crush on Link like they did in Ocarina of Time with Princess Rudo. I thought that, but I thought it was much more subtly done and much better done than in Ocarina of Time in terms of that. Like Ocarina of Time is definitely more as a joke. It was very playful. This felt serious, but super well written, I guess, is the best way I can describe it.
For sure. They did a great job with Mipha.
And then the last couple are Revali, the archer of the Rito, and Urbosa, the chief of the desert dwelling Gerudo, which you were saying she is like a mentor, a mother figure to Princess Zelda.
Yeah, and you get so much of that in the DLC as well, which is so cool.
I did not get around to playing the DLC. My wife got me the DLC for, I have the Wii U version of it. That's what I first played it on. That's what I beat it on. So she got me the season pass for it, so I could get the motorcycle. I just haven't gotten around to doing it yet.
The DLC is really good because you'll get like essentially two or three additional like lore cutscenes of each of the champions. And usually in each one, it shows like a vulnerable side of the champion, but also it'll show a combat scene of the champion. And Urbosa's combat scene is like the coolest thing in the universe. Urbosa's like, oh my God, I'm so excited to play as her when Age of Calamity drops. Cause she has just been in my head, the coolest character in this game, like in that game for the whole time. Like if I could have had Legend of Urbosa, I would have taken that.
Isn't Age of Calamity coming out soon as well, like next week or
in like 11 days or so?
Yeah, so this is kind of perfect timing because this episode will be out on the 15th, so that'll be like a couple days before if it's 11. Am I mathing right? Yeah, so it'd be the Sunday before it comes out. So
hell yeah.
That's kind of perfect timing then. What I was going to say, though, is what I like about her and Link's relationship when she first gets to know him, after she gets the new champions and they have to pick a new knight for her, and Link is the one that gets chosen, she doesn't like Link. And there, you see a couple flashbacks of them having to go through some growing pains together and grow with each other. I thought that was a really cool story mechanic.
And I don't even think it's so much that she doesn't like Link. It's that she doesn't like that Link has this power and ability to protect her when she like quite obviously doesn't want to depend on anybody. And so like Link having obviously like Link is the one with the Triforce of Courage. He's like the courage being, I know they don't use the Triforce really in this game at all, but it's like kind of implied, right? Like he has the hero's power. Like he is the one who has to be like a part of this whole thing. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting relationship dynamic between the two of them, because not until like the end of these flashbacks, when you get to the later flashbacks, do you see a side of Zelda that truly like really cares about this Link. Because at first she's like fucking off trying to like sneak away from him and stuff, and like Link's got to like catch up and find her a bunch of times.
And I like that. I believe it's been a minute since I got to that cutscene, because I was replaying it a little bit on stream actually for this episode, but I didn't get up to that cutscene. But when Link gets mortally injured and she has to put him into that cryostasis in order to save him and then have him awake 100 years later, she feels so guilty because she feels like she's the one that caused him to almost get killed.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a really good scene. And I think one of the boldest moves, one of the boldest differences this dev team did with this game compared to other Zeldas, besides game design, we'll get into game design in a second, but is the voice acting, because you didn't have voice acting like this prior in any other Zelda game. Am I correct? Mm-hmm. I don't think there has been.
Yeah, no, not like this is the first time they've done it like that.
And I think it was super smart to, one, keep Link as a silent protagonist. I think giving him a voice, you would kind of ruin some of the charm, kind of like what happened with Samus in the Other M.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I like that. Actually, I was going to try to surprise you with this. I didn't get it. It didn't work out, but I tried to reach out to the voice actor for King Rome, the king of Hyrule.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see if I could get him on the podcast, like while you were on too, so we could like ask him questions.
Cool.
He never got back to me though. I found his email. I tried to reach out to him, but he never got back to me. So yeah, it happens.
Shoot the shot.
Exactly. Is there any other things that you want to talk about with the story, though? Like, I feel like we kind of scratched the surface, but I don't 100% know what else to dive into. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about with the story?
One particular piece, and it's not so much story as it is side quest, but it's like a side story. But man, I love the Tarrytown side quest so much.
What is the Tarrytown side quest? I don't know if I didn't do a whole lot of the side quests in the game. I did a handful, but I don't know if I did the Tarrytown one.
So the Tarrytown side quest is the one where you get your house in Hatano Village. You buy it from the Bolson and everything. And then after you buy your house, they send Hudson to Tarrytown, and he goes and he starts building this town literally from nothing. And you have to like bring him materials and find him villagers. And so it starts off as this like literally a dude in on a little island with a bunch of boulders, and then you get him a Goron, and the like it's such a charming quest because they have the rule everybody who is a part of this like island has to have their name end in Sun. So you have Hudson, and then you have the Goron that you find, and his name is Grayson and his son Pellison. And then you have to go get you have to go get a Gerudo to be a tailor for the town. So you get Ronson, and then you got to go find a merchant. You find a Rito. His name is Fison. And then at the very end, you've done all this and the town is like beautiful. And they're like, okay, we just need one more person. We need someone who can marry like the original guy, Hudson, and the Gerudo who can get us married. So you go to the Zora place. And I don't remember the name of the Zora you grab, but his name ends in Sun. And you have this big, beautiful wedding in Tarrytown. And as you're building the town, the music evolves and gets like way doper. And it's just like such a nice, heartwarming quest. It has outshined the couple's mask in Majora's Mask for me as my favorite Zelda side quest. And I love it so much.
That is an awesome side quest. I didn't know about that. Anything where it's like a town building mechanic where you can see the town progress, it gives you a sense of ownership of that, because then it's like, look what I did. I helped build this town up from nothing. This was just a couple of fucking rocks, and now it's all this. I love stuff like that.
It's super awesome.
Kind of like what Bravely Default does. I never beat Bravely Default, but you ever played Bravely Default?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I got pretty far in, but I didn't beat it.
I've restarted that game 3 or 4 times because I want to remember, because it'll be like 4 years and then I'm like, oh, I don't remember the story, let me start over. And it's just the same stuff over and over again. I need to really buckle down and beat it. RPGs are so hard for me to get into, not because I dislike them, it's because I don't have the time to sink, you know, so many hours into an
absolutely
RPG, unfortunately.
It was easy to play JRPGs as a kid, but now it's a little more like
And that's what's killing me. But okay, so to move on to the gameplay, because the other big departure, now that we all have the context of the game, you know, you understand how the story is. Link wakes up after 100 years to go defeat Calamity Ganon. The gameplay is so different from every other Zelda game because they went from such a linear style of game, and they kind of went back to what the original Legend of Zelda was, where it was this big open world and lets you explore. And from everything that I've heard, this game is very much, it gives you the same feeling that the original Legend of Zelda did, where you, I was listening to another podcast and I thought they made a good note about this, about how when kids played the original Legend of Zelda game back in the 80s, they would draw out all their own maps and then they would discover new things. And so then every day on the school, on the playground, they would come together, compare each other's maps. And then they together, this community of friends would piece together this larger map so they could understand all the secrets that the original Legend of Zelda had. And I feel like Breath of the Wild has done that too, to a degree. Obviously, it's a lot easier to do that on the internet, but just even when we were talking before, how your community banded together to find the 899 locations you already got to find that last missing one. That's a similar type of feeling where this game, you're going to find new stuff in it that you never knew existed almost every time you play it, depending on how deep you look and how far you go. And that's a really cool feeling and mechanic to put back into Zelda when for years it's been so stagnant with the same type of formula.
Yeah, it's like they took such a massive jump away from the traditional get item, beat dungeon, move on, get item, beat dungeon, move on formula. And people say this sometimes where they're like, man, it doesn't even feel like a Zelda game. And it's an interesting thought, because what is like the formula for a Zelda game? Because when you think about the differences between each and every one, like, Majora's Mask added this weird time mechanic, and Wind Waker added this weird ocean mechanic. Twilight Princess added this dog mechanic, and then you got Skyward Sword that added this like massive. Skyward Sword is arguably the most linear of them, so it's hard to use that one as an example. But had the like interconnected upper and lower worlds.
Well, that's funny, because that was actually Breath of the Wild was a direct response to Skyward Sword. The linearity of Skyward Sword was criticized by a lot of gamers, so their response to that was to create their first open world, like truly open world Zelda game, and probably one of their first really open world 3D, like 3D.
Yeah, games. I can't think of any like Nintendo open world games like that.
Could you make the argument that Metroid Prime is kind of like that?
Maybe in a sense, but not quite as much, I think. Where
you're right, because a lot of it's gated by your abilities.
Exactly. It has the standard adventure like progression, say like the Metroidvania style. You can access this area once you get the ice beam. So like there is this big world to explore, and you have to backtrack to like do everything. Like they give you an ice door in the first area, and if you come back 13 hours later, you can get an extra like energy container or something. But it's not like an open, like it is a guided world.
Well, and what I think with Breath of the Wild, the way they kind of circumvent that guided feel is just you can literally go anywhere. As long as you have the stamina to climb, or you find a way to climb up with what limited stamina you have at the beginning, you can literally, like, you see a mountain, you can go to the top of it. It just lets you constantly explore and constantly find new things. And actually, I was looking up one of their design things. Let me look it up real quick here. And they noticed early on in development that a lot of players were following similar paths. And because of that, a lot of players felt it was still too linear. So what they originally did was they just had a lot of the towers that you would see. We haven't talked about it yet, but sprinkled throughout the entirety of the Breath of the Wild map are these basically like radio towers. That's not what they're called. They're Sheikah towers, right? I think I forget what.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I don't know what exactly their names are, but they're basically towers from the Sheikah that fill up your map. Yeah.
And what I think is a good, cool thing that they do, it's because that's something that like Assassin's Creed does, a lot of Ubisoft open worlds games do. But what they do that's different from those is that in Ubisoft games, when you get that tower, they give you all your objectives on your mini map. In Breath of the Wild, you have to look around the map to see what your next objective is. Like, you get to decide what your next objective is, and they don't overload you with them. They give you, you know, five or six to look at most from that tower, and it incentivizes you to then go look in that direction.
Yeah. And now that you mentioned it, another funny thing too is like during their internal testing, when they were placing the Koroks, they specifically would target areas that were the least traveled by their testers. So they were like, as another incentive to get people exploring every nook and cranny of this big world they designed, they added these Koroks into the areas that people didn't naturally venture into.
I did not know that. That's actually really cool.
Yeah, it's a really neat way because it trains your mind into thinking like, oh, look at that area I would never go to. I should go there.
It's such a good design idea. And actually, to get to that idea that you're just talking about, since all these players were going on so many similar paths, and also they kind of still felt a little bit too led by the hand, to fix this, Nintendo hit a lot of points of interest behind other objects, usually behind hills or mountains. So mm-hmm. depending on how the player traversed that mountain, whether it was straight up and over, around one side, around another, they would see different points of interest depending on how the player traversed it. So that way it wasn't the same. Because technically, if everyone goes around the other side of the mountain, you're going to get to the same point of interest, but the things you see along the way are going to be vastly different because they give the player such a wealth of options to explore around this mountain, which I thought was a really cool idea.
Yeah, that is really clever. I like that a lot.
This was also the first Zelda game to be built from the ground up with HD in mind. This was no other Zelda game had been built from the ground up for an HD console. One of the things I looked up beforehand, which I thought was kind of cool to test this, to figure out what they want to do with the art direction for the game, they actually created a little tech demo for Wind Waker HD and Twilight Princess HD to kind of get an idea of what they wanted it to look like. They ultimately went with Wind Waker because of how colorful it was. And as you can see now, it's not exactly like Wind Waker. It's kind of like this weird hybrid between the two, between Twilight Princess and between Wind Waker. But because of that tech demo, it led to the creation of Wind Waker HD and Twilight Princess HD. So that's how far in advance they were planning this game.
Interesting. That's actually a really cool thing. I didn't know that.
A lot of the stuff that I like to look up, have you ever heard of a YouTube channel called Did You Know Gaming?
Yeah, I love Did You Know Gaming.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff was from them. They do such good research, man. There's so many cool things. I have like four fucking pages of notes. I'm not planning on going through all of it, but I kind of like to take notes so it's in my head, and then I will, as the conversation goes along, we'll see how, you know, see what comes up naturally. I don't want to try to force it into conversation or anything, but yeah. So the other cool thing is the abilities you get. What I thought was the most interesting about Breath of the Wild's game design is that, unlike other Zeldas where you progress through each temple and you get a new item in each temple, they give you all of your items slash abilities right off the bat, with the exception of some supplemental ones from the Guardians or from the Divine Beasts.
Mm-hmm.
So you get, you know, the two different kinds of bombs. You get Magnesis, you get Stasis, and you get Cryos, right? Yeah, those are the...
Yeah, I think that's everything.
And they give you just those couple of abilities, and then the rest, it's just every single shrine is just is like, instead of having a bunch of like 8 or 9 or like 12 or 15 big dungeons, they have how many shrines? Like there's over 100, right? There's
120 shrines, and then you got the four divine beasts.
So they have four somewhat big, like medium-sized dungeons, and then they have 100 small dungeons. So they have these cool little experimentations. It's almost kind of like Mario-esque, because Mario, in all those games, they pick a small, like they pick a mechanic for a level, and then they see how much they can iterate on it through that level. Or they give Mario his moveset, and then each level is a different iteration on that moveset with different, like, what challenges can we do within these limited abilities we've given Mario. And they kind of did that with this, where they gave you those six, and depending on what you do with the shrine, each shrine teaches you a different ability or a different way to think with those abilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a lot of like interesting little puzzles built where you're like, oh man, I can put my Cryosis on the waterfall. Like, you learn all these interesting little ways. Basically, it was part of their way of saying like, look, we really made a lot of interesting ways for you to interact with this world, and just in case you're not exploring it to its fullest, we're going to give you a shrine where you have to burn a bunch of grass. So now you know you can burn grass. So go do that elsewhere. Go have fun and burn some shit. Or like here's some manipulation you can do with some metal objects. Now go do that in the world. All this kind of weird stuff.
And I think the one that like really sticks out to me is watching speedrunners break this game. The one that blew my fucking mind was when I watched, it was one of the earliest speedruns of the game. It was, I think, because Breath of the Wild came out in what, March of 2017. And I believe there was a run for it already at SGDQ 2017. And the runner cut down a tree, threw it into stasis,
hit the shit out of it,
and then stood on the tree, and I just watched them launch and go off, and I'm like, oh my god, you can do that? I never would have thought of that before.
Yeah, it is, and it just gets crazier and crazier. Like, it started off nuts, and then now the tricks they're doing, dude, oh, it's nasty.
Have you ever tried speedrunning this?
Oh, I've done dog percent runs of this game where you feed every dog that gives you treasure, you feed them as fast as possible. So I've not done traditional runs, but I have learned like the techniques that speedrunners use, including the boomy zoomy, which is called the bomb impact launch, where you essentially you drop a circle bomb and then you drop a square bomb. And you use the circle bomb to blow up the square bomb into Link while Link is in bullet time, as you can do while you're aiming your bow in midair. And if you do it perfectly, you can then fly across the land the same way you do when you like launch off the tree. Yeah, it's really interesting. And the way it works is that because the game's bullet time works the way it does, every force of physics that's applied during bullet time, when time gets sped up back to normal, speeds up in the same way as the time does. So if I push something 1 meter away in bullet time, it will get pushed 13 meters away by the time we're in normal time. So the speed factor is 13. And when you exploit that to essentially launch yourself around Hyrule, you could even do it in midair. So like, you can be sailing through the air, drop two bombs, blow yourself up to gain massive speed, and then sail through the air longer. And as long as you have stamina food and hearts, you can literally cover one side of the map to the other without ever touching the ground.
That's insane. I had no idea. Like, there's so many different mechanics I have no idea exist about this game. That's fucking cool. Are there any others that speedrunners utilize?
Oh, yeah. There's all sorts of ways they exploit that bullet time. The big one is called the bullet time bounce, which is very similar, but instead of using a bomb to gain momentum, you shield jump onto an enemy's head. And if you land on them in the perfect spot, you will just fling with the most tremendous speed. It's like, if they set it up in the run where when they're going from the temple that you get the sailcloth from, you jump directly off the tower and shield flip onto an enemy. And as soon as you're about to hit him, you bring out your bow and then you go flying and you land from that area to the castle in like 12 seconds.
That's wild. I will never have the patience to, well, or the time, but the patience to sit down and do that. That's so crazy. I don't know. I think the way they designed this game is just so smartly done. And I feel like I've been talking a whole bunch about this, so I'm sorry that I feel like I've been like talking over you at all. So
no, not at all.
What are some of your thoughts on the gameplay? Anything you want to add to this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the biggest thing that we're kind of talking about here is like the change in style between, you know, like you have these ruins and you have this set of abilities, but you don't really discover new abilities once you're past the initial spot of the game beyond the guardian or the champion abilities. And we could argue that between them, only two of them really alter your gameplay in any significant way, because Revali's Gale gives you the power of flight and Urbosa's Fury gives you this cool lightning spin attack. But the others are just a revive and a shield. So they don't really do anything in the sense of like opening up new opportunities for your gameplay. So it kind of like gives you this, it can feel a little lackluster at points where you're sitting around, you're going like, man, this is such a cool game, but I haven't gotten a new ability in a really long time. And that's part of the excitement of Zelda games. It's like you go, you finish the dungeon and like, oh my God, I got a hookshot, like kind of thing. And that's kind of something I want to see in the sequel. I want to be able to take these spirit orbs that I'm getting from shrines or however they decide to do it. But I want progression in my abilities. It doesn't necessarily have to be like massive things. I don't need to unlock a hookshot that's going to let me like cheese through a dungeon, but maybe like unlock an ability that gives Link a new combat technique, or unlock an ability that gives Link a new sprinting technique, or even like the ability to just sprint faster by default that's not related to the armor. That's another good point, too, is like the armor was a really interesting thing in this game where in previous games, you only swapped out armor to be like, I need to breathe underwater or I need to resist lava.
And the weapons in general are so different. In every other game, you just have your sword, you know, the Kokiri sword in Zelda and Ocarina of Time. I mean, and then you get your Master Sword. And in each game, you just found some sword that you were there with that permanently.
Yeah. And in this game, you pick up a club from some dude you threw a box at.
Yep. And you never know what you're going to get. I hated that at first, man. That was my biggest pet peeve because I hated the fact that I had to constantly keep... You basically develop this economy of weapons, this inventory economy of like, okay, I have a weapon that does 20 damage right now and a weapon that does 4 damage right now and a weapon that does like 35. I'm going to use the shitty one first so that way when I get to the boss, I can use my 35 so I can swing and beat the shit out of that thing so I can kill it faster.
Yeah.
Or like certain weapons are better for certain things. Like hammers are really good for when you use stasis so that way you can like swing and like get a lot of damage and like angle it off the right way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or axes for chopping down trees.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Each weapon has kind of like their own applications and like interesting little ways that they do swing and everything. But while awesome, I know a lot of people hated the durability system within them. How did you feel about the durability?
I didn't like how fragile some of the things were, but I do like how when you break a weapon, it does a lot more damage than what it would have been if it was just a normal swing. I thought that was a cool thing where it's
that
like
is
the
kinda
final
neat.
Hoorah,
yeah.
The final hoorah of that weapon. It will exponentially do so much more damage. And it's just cool. It's so satisfying when you break a weapon on an enemy and it kills them. That just it's such a fun it makes you feel good, which is kind of weird to say out of context, but
yeah, no, I love throwing my weapons at enemies too. Like throwing a sword at a guy is just like just so comical. Like, why was that even an option? Who knows, but it's hilarious.
I was streaming it on Sunday and I tried to throw a spear at this guy from far away and I just limp dicked it by accident. It just kind of dribbled straight down and did nothing, and I just went, oh.
And I bet it still broke too, right?
No, it didn't actually, because like I wound up the throw and it just kind of went brrr. And so I was able to sneak behind the tower the guys were at, and I picked it back up, and I tried to use a sneak strike on one of the enemies, and it didn't work. They saw me, and there was a ton of them, and I got killed fast. The one thing I will say, well, I mean, we've been saying a lot of stuff, but one thing that really stuck out with me besides the weapon system, this game's tough. A lot tougher than other Zeldas.
Yeah, the way the difficulty scales is interesting because I learned this when I was attempting the 3-heart gold Lionel challenge. But you notice how
I never beat a Lionel.
Oh, you never beat a Lionel?
No,
oh, you
got to
go
didn't.
Back. You got to conquer it, dude.
All right. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, not at all.
3-heart gold Lionel challenge.
Yeah. So for those like essentially every enemy in the game works in a way where they have their base version and then they have like scaling up difficulty versions that. They get a bigger health pool, they deal more damage, and I'm not entirely certain, but I think in some cases they'll gain an ability or two. The Lionels, they start off red, they go blue, then they go silver, and then they go gold, but only if you're playing on master mode. So
okay.
You'll notice in the game when you're playing it that like as you're beating dungeons and getting further that, you know, more enemies that are of these like more difficult colors start to spawn, which is an interesting thing to notice because it is an open world game that lets you and encourages you to go anywhere and everywhere whenever you want. So how do you tackle the challenge of making sure your game maintains its difficulty level throughout that entire adventure when you don't know where the player is going to go? So what they did, and what I absolutely think is so creative, is they created this system where you have an internal point score. And every time you kill an enemy, every time you complete a specific certain task, your point score will rise. And at certain thresholds, these enemy spawns will change into different enemy spawns pending the next Blood Moon reset. So if I kill 100 enemies, then this camp that was once 3 red bokoblins is now 1 blue bokoblin and 2 red ones. If I get 200 points, it now becomes 2 blues and 1 red. You get like 500 points. There's a lizard there now. And there's all these interesting, like every single part of this game that has enemy spawns incorporates this feature, which is like, it's a massive world. We've played it like this game. This world is incredibly large. So that entire system like, is just such a cool way of doing it. And most people don't really tally up points that fast until they beat their first Divine Beast, which will give you 70 points upon completion.
Okay.
So, yeah, each Divine Beast kind of, like, is enough not to push you too far, but that's probably crazy. To throw you into whatever the next threshold is for an enemy upgrade.
I didn't know that's how its difficulty system worked. That's a really smart way to do it. That's mm-hmm. so well done. So it's such a simple solution to such what could have been such a complex problem. Because when you when you have that massive open world, how do you determine the player's skill level? And so I'm assuming your three heart gold star or gold Lionel is, you just do you fight through all the divine beasts, or do you just kill a shitload of enemies until you get up to a certain
I essentially, so Ganon actually gives you like 150 points. So I fought Ganon, I did the beasts, but you need a lot of points. I essentially had to take down like 40 Lionels until a gold one spawned, and at that point I was so like used to their like the way that they fought that the gold Lionel wasn't even a challenge. Like, I just walked up to him, headshot him, smack him up. And then like 20 minutes later, bingo, bango, bongo, it's done. Like, he didn't lay a hand on me.
That's funny. That's a little disappointing when you put all that effort to go fight him.
Yeah,
and then it's
it was
just like
18 hours to get to it. And then by the time I got to it, it was like, okay, well, that's another like fun 6 minutes.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that, the fact that they include all that stuff in there, I just think it just shows how good their game design is. And yeah, it just, I don't know. I just, there's so much about this game that I'm just impressed by, and their design mechanics for it. And the way, like you were saying, some people complain that it didn't feel like Zelda. And I actually disagree with that. I still think it held that Zelda spirit. And I think Zelda is a lot more of an aesthetic than it is of a gameplay style now. I think that's what they kind of showed with Breath of the Wild. And besides, if you look at the original three Zelda games, they're nothing like each other.
Yeah.
You know, Zelda 1, Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link, and then Link to the Past. Like, Link to the Past and the original, you could see is definitely like a spiritual sequel. Well, not spiritual, but a sequel in terms of everything. You know, it feels like the original, but also changes a whole bunch. But it is still very different. It's a lot more linear than the original one was, and there's a lot more items that you can choose from. So, like, what Link to the Past did to the formula and kind of standardized Zelda for so long, up until that, there wasn't a standard formula. Each Zelda game was completely different from the last. And it wasn't until people decided, like, all right, Link to the Past works, so let's keep doing it. I mean, it kind of makes sense, because what Nintendo did with the N64 was they took a tried and true concept. We're like, all right, let's try to make the transition into 3D as easy as possible. Let's do something. Let's take something that works already in 2D and figure out how that best transitions into 3D. So they took essentially the story of Link to the Past and put it into Ocarina of Time, because that way that's less work for them to have to do. They did tweak it a bit. They still tweaked it. I'm not saying it's a ripoff, but they did. They kind of took a simple route out where they kind of kept the same core overall design layout.
Yeah,
just
get the medallions, get the pendants, all that stuff.
So
yeah,
it's very much, I mean, and if you look at Link to the Past, what, you get three medallions at first, you get three of the stones at the beginning of Ocarina of Time, and then the world opens up and you have to collect all the different medallions in Ocarina of Time. I forget what you collect in Link to the Past. I thought it was three medallions at first. Is it more medallions after?
Past, it's exactly the same. You get three, you get the sword, and then the sword is the link to the next world, where in, you know, Link to the Past, you got Dark World, Ocarina of Time, you got Future World. And then at that point, you got another seven things to pick up.
Yeah, and so they kept the same formula just for ease, but because Ocarina was so popular, and because Link to the Past was so popular, and then when Majora's came out, it wasn't as popular. It's now beloved, but you know, at the time it didn't release to as high praise as Ocarina of Time did. So they kind of went back to something similar, which is why Wind Waker is three dungeons. Once again, a big incident happens, and then you have to go to a bunch of other seven more dungeons, and then it kind of stayed that way up until, I mean, there was some deviations, of course, small ones here and there, and then Link Between the Worlds was a big deviation, and then you have, you know, Breath of the Wild, which just kind of threw out that whole convention and just said, let's stop guiding the player anywhere. Just let them explore where they want to. No more gatekeeping. Only gatekeeping is the player's skill, not the items that they have, or not the items they've acquired so far.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was such a cool idea, such a cool mechanic. And even on the plateau, because we didn't even really talk about how the beginning of the game starts, where the game starts on this plateau where you get all six of your abilities, six or seven, I forget how many now. I think it's six, where you get all your abilities. They teach you about pretty much everything you need to know to survive that world, like just the basics of it, right on that plateau. Because even they don't give you the heat element, they give you the cold element. They teach you that there are temperatures in this world and you have to find a way to combat those temperatures, whether it's by food, which we haven't talked about the food mechanic at all, which right. I guess that should be the next thing, food, or by clothes. And they show you that right off the bat. I go for the clothes because I don't like dealing with timers, but that's just me. But the cooking mechanic was such a cool thing. Did you enjoy the cooking parts of it?
Oh, I love the cooking mechanic. It was so interesting. You spent so much time like experimenting and figuring it out, and like you actually got to learn stuff from the NPCs about like mix this, 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 and this, and you'll get a cake or some shit. There was so much depth to it. It was so interesting.
And it's fun. It gives you that sense of satisfaction because it's not like they hide ingredients from you. There's so many ingredients everywhere. So it encourages you to experiment with it and try weird different things. I do think it's funny though, when you make something that isn't good and it turns into that like slodge or whatever, and Link just looks really defeated every time he like, cooks it. It makes me laugh every single time. And I don't know. I just love the cooking mechanic. I like that. For some reason, every time I do it, though, it makes me want to have hot wings just because of the peppers. I don't know why. It's a weird, like, association thing. What are some of your favorite things to cook in there? Actually, it's kind of a weird question, and I don't know if you have the answer to it, but did it inspire you to cook anything in the real world?
No, not really anything in the real world, but in the game, I think the most exciting thing for me to, like, figure out how to cook was, like, really figuring out how the bonuses worked for the foods. I never really I didn't try super hard to figure out specific dishes, but I was very focused on like, okay, so why did this one give me level 3 additional armor for 5 minutes? And why did this one give me level 2 additional armor for 10 minutes? And trying to like find out what was going on there was so interesting and fun. And eventually, because I was doing this challenge, I needed triple speed food for 30 minutes all the time. And like, I got to like, I really dug in. Like, there was a group of people who like really experimented and created spreadsheets upon spreadsheets of how to cook stuff. And so I found the perfect recipe that would give you every single time you would get a speed boost for 30 minutes at level 3. So a perfect, amazing speed boost. And all it took was, I think, 4 Fleet Lotus seeds or 3 and 1 Dragon's Horn.
Where do you get all those from?
They and any like swamp or marsh kind of area. In all the marshes, you would find these seeds. And then there was a really easy way to farm horns off of Farosh, the dragon from the Farosh region, or from the Necluda region, or whatever it was called, the jungle region.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. That's kind of like southeast-ish.
Yes.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah.
That was my favorite zone. I love jungle zones. I don't know. Ever since I was a kid, I've been obsessed with jungles. I don't know why. Just visually, they look really cool to me. When I played World of Warcraft, my favorite was like Ferelis, because it was this big wooded zone. I don't know if you ever played WoW, but
long, long time ago, but I don't know if I remember that zone.
That was a zone in Nilla WoW. I don't know if it's still in the... I mean, they kind of brought stuff back. I don't know. I don't know what WoW is anymore. It's so different from when I played it like 10 years ago or so. But okay, so let's move on. We've talked a lot about the gameplay. We've talked a lot about the story. Let's kind of talk about the overall aesthetic, like the visuals and music. Because a lot of times I like to devote one section to visuals and one section to music. But Breath of the Wild, we could probably talk a decent amount about the visuals, but the music is very minimalist, which I think works really well. Do you listen to the soundtrack at all, like outside of the game? Do you like it enough, or does it feel like something that's perfect for the game world?
I don't know if I've listened to it too much like outside of the game. I've listened to it a little bit, but the music in the game feels very much like it is built for the game. And like the, I know the whole soundtrack in the game in many areas is like kind of, if you're not in a city, then you're just listening to nature. You're listening to Link step around. And when you encounter enemies, you're going to hear the combat theme a little bit. But most of the time, you're kind of like in silence or in nature, and you're hearing all these various sounds that Link is making, which is worth mentioning because they actually worked really hard on making those sounds very special and unique because of how often you'd be hearing them. I think there's somewhat of like maybe 200 to 400 separate footstep sounds for Link just on grass and mud. Yeah, just on grass and mud.
That's so much attention to detail. I had no idea they did that.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think it's called foiling or foliage or something. I'm not sure what folly. It's called folly. And it's like the job of the person who has to like,
oh, foley work.
Yeah, they have to record all like weird interactive sound effects like that, like footsteps and things clinking against each other. And so they put so much effort into that that it was incredible. But going on to the music. Not to go too far off track here, but going on to the music.
No, by all means.
You can, like, when you think back to the other Zelda games, you don't really see a game where they really gave too much focus to a piano. Like,
no.
Usually they have, like, these beautiful string instruments, the flutes, the ocarina, obviously. But in Breath of the Wild, they really give you a lot of these, like, random piano chords to kind of, like, guide you through and be this good feeling emotion while you're going in. And It's a beautiful touch.
It's very zen. It's very meditative, I feel like. I feel like the game is very much, I mean, obviously when you're in combat, that's different. But when you're kind of just exploring around the world, they have very light piano stings. Like, it's not like you hear a melody. You just kind of hear, like you said, just a couple little dun, dun, or something along
those
lines.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it kind of, it's
very ambient.
It keeps you engaged just enough. But it becomes such a zen experience to kind of play through the game. And, like, the game is so beautiful, like, visually. And what I think Nintendo has done that excelled in this so much is their art direction. But before I talk about that, I just want to make a comment about the Foley work. Have you ever seen a video of Foley artists?
Yeah.
Or see what they do?
Yeah.
I love watching that. It is one of the coolest things, just seeing all the weird sounds that they – all the weird items they use to create sounds. Like, apparently – one of the first sounds for like a nuclear bomb was a toilet flushing. They just stuck a mic down into the bowl of a toilet, not into the water, but into the bowl, and just flushed. And the sound created the explosion sound, apparently. Which,
yeah, they got to get real creative.
Who would have known?
Right.
So yeah, I know the whole visual aesthetic though. I think is so beautiful. I love that it's cel shaded, but not too much. And Nintendo's art direction in most of their games is just so good. Like, if you go back and look at, even like you were playing a lot of the Mario games, like on the 3D collection, Mario Galaxy still looks good. It looks really, really good. That's because their art direction is so fucking strong that it still holds up today. That's why I feel like, look at like the Sly Cooper games. If you play that on a PS2, it still looks pretty decent. Depending on how they design their art can really influence it going forward. That's why I feel like old realistic games, like, I'm a big Medal of Honor fan, but if you go back and play those games, they don't look too hot.
No, absolutely. A game with like an interesting art style will usually like stand the test of time a little better. And I think the best example of that is Wind Waker. Look at Wind Waker
100%.
On the GameCube versus anything on the PS2 that was going for realism. And Wind Waker is going to look better.
100%. And like the fact that they kind of went for that cel-shaded look here, but just did it a little bit different, I thought was such a good touch. And they didn't have to go for the highest resolution. They didn't need the highest polygon count in order to get this thing to look good. They picked such a clear and concise art direction that it just works. Like, I don't know. I don't really have much else to say about it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, I think the design of the various monsters and creatures of the world was also just so, so good. Like, we've seen these monsters plenty of times, but obviously, like, each title, they rework them. And in Breath of the Wild, we reworked everything to kind of feel like anything that wasn't a bokoblin or like a moblin or anything like that, like, you really felt like they were wild creatures, you know? You really felt like they were like these beings that just kind of existed, and you know, you run into some lizards and sorry dude, you got to fight them. These lizards are territorial or whatever.
It makes the world feel so much more fleshed out than other Zelda games prior.
It really does. When I explored for the Korok seeds, I did not feel at all like I was like I wasn't getting bored. Every corner of this world had so much love and care put into it, and it shows when you go and like you literally comb it up and down inch by inch. You can see it.
And what's even cooler is the fact that they didn't feel the need to jam every single thing, every single corner with something that's interesting, if that makes sense. Like the world is so well designed that there's just, if there's not a point of interest in that one particular spot, like not a Korok seed, not a shrine, not a town, not anything, it's still just a beautiful view, or it gives you something to look to in order to determine your next location. Like everywhere you look, there's a point of interest. And it kind of reminds me, I forget what exactly it's called off the top of my head, but when Walt Disney designed Disneyland and Disney World, what he did was that he would get down onto the height of a child. So when a child walked into Disney World, what would be their points of interest? Mm-hmm. And so that's why the first thing you see when you walk into Disney World is generally, you know, Cinderella's castle, because you just see this long street road. You see this long street, shops and stuff on the side. But the first thing that kid's going to see is that giant castle that they're looking straight up at.
Yeah.
And then so they walk to that castle. And then once they get to that castle, then you can see all the different, then you can see some point of interest in each of the different, you know, zones, whether like, you know, maybe a roller coaster off on this side, or maybe a tall tower over here. So there's always something for you to look at, to point your eye to. So it catches your eye. And Breath of the Wild does that to an extreme, because obviously with a theme park, you only have to worry about so many different locations versus a video game. There's a shitload more. But they kind of do that with every little thing, where it's like, oh, this is a, look at that grotto over there. Look at that thicket of woods. Like, that looks a little bit interesting. I wonder if there's anything in there. And it's just such a, the way they, the art direction just makes everything look appealing. So it makes you want to go explore.
It really does. Yeah. And that's an interesting thought process, because now that you mention it, like, they do give you these interesting, like, visual stimulus from when I think about it, from each one of the main towns. If you look outside of it, you have these areas. You're like, well, that looks cool. That looks cool. That looks cool. And those are like the areas you're probably going to head to. And each one of them has cool shit hidden at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to say? I don't have much more about to say about the game. I do have some cool little facts that I looked up from that Did You Know Gaming video I mentioned earlier that I just kind of want to read off. But is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you wanted to go into?
We covered gameplay. We covered story. We covered music. We covered visuals. It's... Man, I can't sing this game's praises hard enough. Like, I think it's one of the greatest games that's been created. I think the one thing I'll add is it's not without its flaws. And the one thing like bugged me about the game was the lack of creativity between the shrines, because there were so many shrines that were repeats of each other, and then there was like maybe 20 to 25 separate like tests of strength, which are the same shrine. And then there was
combat shrines, right?
Exactly. And then there was like all those shrines where the puzzle was the overworld getting into it. But I still wanted the internal shrine puzzle too. So I was like, ah, oh, come on, man. Like, like, you can't give me the reward was the friends you made along the way. Like, no, I don't want that. I want the puzzle. Give me the puzzle.
It's funny. I made that joke literally last week too. The friends you made along the way. I forget what context it was in. No, and what would you say to people who think this game is overrated? Because I actually hear not a lot. I mean, there's a small but vocal contingent of people online that I hear say, you know, like, oh, this game isn't nearly as good, generally criticizing the story and stuff, but or the change in gameplay. But what would you say, like, what would be one of the reasons that they should give this game another try?
I think the game is very Nintendo, like it's a very Nintendo game in that they don't tell you how to have fun. Like they don't tell you what to do to have fun. Like it's not like playing Xbox or PlayStation where you boot up a game and you have an achievement list and you're like, oh, that's my challenge. I'm going to go do that. It's going to be fun. Mm-hmm. And no shade to that, but it's very much what you make it. And their game has so many interesting little things caked into it that the best way to experience it is to just kind of like do whatever you feel like doing in the game. Like, let the game suck you in wherever it does. And if it doesn't do that, then maybe it's not the game for you. But for me, I had no trouble like getting sucked into these various parts of the world. And like, I don't know about you, when I first started, I spent my first 6 hours running around that field like an idiot because I didn't want to go quest. I wanted to be like, oh, look at that waterfall. I bet there's a fire sword behind it. Like, everything has a secret. And some of them are sick. Some of them are a little disappointing. But every part of the world has a secret hidden in it. And it's so fun to just explore it all.
And when you first started playing, how often did you share stuff with your friends? You know, like how often when all you and your friends are playing when it first came out, where you would say, oh, I did this, this, and this. And a friend would be like, holy crap, you did that? I didn't know you could do that. And vice versa. They might be saying something to you where they did something. You're like, holy crap, I didn't know you could do that either. And that sense of discovery is something that is so hard, especially for adults, man. Yeah. It's so hard to get that sense of discovery as an adult because you've seen so much. And Breath of the Wild, I think, really brought that back in a big bad way. I think it did a really good job of doing that. And to all those listening, when I asked Xwater to come on, I originally was going to interview him, but when he mentioned that you like the format of my show where we kind of do a deep dive on each game, I was like, well, the only one I know that like you that I saw you play recently, or the one that first popped in my head, I should say, was Breath of the Wild. And I was like, I know you did the 900 Korok Seeds. I don't know if you're going to want to do another full episode on Breath of the Wild. And you immediately jumped on it, like, right away. Like, no, it's one of my top... you said, like, top three, right?
Yeah, top three games for sure. Mario Odyssey is my number one game. I think it's got the best movement of any game that exists. I'm a platformer fan, so it just hits all the good spots for me.
Yes.
And then... probably Breath of the Wild at number two. I said top three because I like to leave a little wiggle room for myself, though.
What would be your number three right now?
That's so hard. I don't know.
You were able to narrow down your one, but not your three?
Well, your number one is like, think about what your favorite ice cream is, right? And you're going to have something, but what's your third favorite? Because, you know, there's one you're passionate about. And then the second two, you love both of them. And it's so hard to like say which is better. But there's so many games that I cherish so hard. Like, well, go ahead. What are your top three?
Well, I don't have a top. I was going to say for ice cream, it's cookies and cream number one.
Same.
Chocolate chip cookie dough number two.
Nice.
And then maybe salted caramel for number three.
Okay. All right.
I'm a big cookies and cream fan though. Like, whenever I go to Dairy Queen, I always get Oreo Blizzards. That's like my go-to.
I do love cookies and cream, and I also love cookie dough. Those are my top two as well. So
there you go. Yeah. For games though, that's a tough question because it's weird. So my feeling on games is so tied to my emotions and not necessarily, well, I mean, that makes sense because it's your favorite, but like it's so tied to what I'm feeling in that moment. So if you were to ask me now, what is my favorite game of all time? Right now, it's Horizon Zero Dawn, just because that's the game that I like. That's the game that last made a huge impact on me. But if you were to ask me, like, maybe another week or so, like another month or so, it might be one of the Medal of Honor games. It switches up a lot.
Changes for you, yes. Yeah.
And I can never really pinpoint it. So some last notes before we close this out, because now we have been going for like an hour and a half now. Some last notes. I don't know if we said, I said it as a joke before we hit recording, but the Korok seeds are Korok poop.
Oh, they are. Yep. That is the reward for getting joke. All 900 is literally a pile of shit.
I love that. I think that's so good. Some other fun facts. Early in development, during brainstorming sessions, it led to two different game ideas. One was called Hyrule Wars, which involved Link running between two massive armies. And there's actually a tech demo that was on the Did You Know Gaming video of you seeing Link with these like explosions going everywhere, just running around a battlefield. And the second one was a little bit more weird. It was Legend of Zelda Invasion, and it was about aliens abducting cattle, which I guess was like from Majora's Mask.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of cool. This is one of my favorite little facts. So the game director, Hidemaru Fujibayashi, to get a sense of scale and perspective in the game, they took the game world map and overlaid a map of Kyoto on top of it. So that way he could see, like, all right, it takes, you know, from this spot in Kyoto to that spot, it takes about, you know, 20 minutes. So how long is the distance in the game world? So he kind of used that as a way to a perspective.
Interesting.
I thought that was really interesting. There's a bunch of other ones. I'll kind of end off with this one because I thought this was kind of a cool thing showing the direction that Nintendo is going in the future. During development, some younger developers at Nintendo were working on another game that had a large-scale world or a large open world. So the Zelda vets, who were not accustomed to designing games like that, actually stepped aside to let the younger programmers go to work. And while there were still some growing pains with it, they actually, you know, actively stepped down to let these newcomers kind of show them the ropes of how to develop an open world game, which I thought was kind of cool that, because normally you don't see that. Normally you see the vets kind of taking the mantle, but they didn't. They let these young guns kind of figure it out for themselves.
Yeah, and I know that's been happening a lot at Nintendo these last, like, during this Switch era, they've let the young generation at the company kind of do a little bit more in terms of, like, the leadership roles on these projects, and their success has been showing with it, so I hope they can, I hope they keep it up, but, like, it is really, really, really cool to see that they're, you know, trying so hard to, well, giving the new generation a chance, right?
And that's something that a lot of companies don't do, not just Nintendo, not just like a game company, but you always go with what's tried and true and you don't always try something that's experimental. All right. So with all that said, that is Breath of the Wild. Now, first off, X-Water, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun getting to know you. I hope I didn't ramble too much. I have a tendency to talk over people every now and then.
No, it was a good time. I think we did a good show today.
I do too. Is there anything you'd like to plug, and where can the good people find you on social media?
Just search X-Water if you want to find my content. I'm on YouTube, Twitch. I post stuff on Twitter and Instagram, all that stuff. And if you want to listen to myself and speedrunner Grand Pooh Bear, savant developer Jakku talk about whatever madness is going on in the gaming world that week, we do our own podcast over at the Warp World Podcast as well. So that's probably it for me.
And I can recommend the Warp World Podcast. That's how I found X-Water. I really like the podcast, and it's definitely worth. I actually use you guys more often to kind of keep up with gaming news and in the Twitch world, because a lot of the gaming news, for the most part, I can keep up with, but a lot of Twitch stuff is way over my head. So I kind of, because I'm not actively part of that community.
Yeah.
So I love listening to you guys. So that way I can kind of keep abreast of what's going on.
We usually got one hand in on the skinny going on over there.
Oh yeah. And that's, I'm grateful for it, because I know next thing, Twitch is like, since I, like I said, I'm in my early 30, I'm 31. So Twitch, and I think Pooh Bear is older than me a little bit, but it's,
but
he's actively involved in the community. But since it's something that kind of came after I got into everything, it's like, I understand it. I get it, but at the same time, I don't know all the intricacies of it. So it's kind of fun to listen to you guys who do know the intricacies, so I can learn more about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so as usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to reach out to me, you can email me at StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. You can also support the show in a number of ways. You can go to Patreon.com/StillLoadingPod. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. And honestly, what's even more helpful is giving it a 5-star rating review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That helps get more exposure for the show and helps more people find it and hopes more people listen. And I'm part of the Podbeard Network. You can go check it out, podbeardnetwork.com, for all the shows on there. And the most important and final plug I have, the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at hospitals. If you want to help out, you can go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that will do it for this episode of the Still Loading Podcast. X-Water, thank you once again for joining me.
Absolutely, man. It's been a pleasure.
And I will see you all next time.